Good morning, Semi.
Good morning, everyone. So we're going to try to do this series of shiurim on how Beit Din in the Hebrew slash Jewish system works, both from a legal perspective and from a philosophical perspective. This is a topic that I feel is almost never addressed, even for people who are like learning Masechah Sanhedrin in a yeshiva setting. These things aren't really spoken out in any explicit fashion, and it's an interesting topic just because it really, really blends together in a very powerful and practical, as we'll see, practical way, both the philosophical and the legal side of Jewish court systems. So there's going to be a lot of information over here. I think our slot we said is about 30 minutes. Bruce, is that what
No,
we?
you can take
Yeah.
anywhere from 11 to 12 as long as we're awake,
Okay,
whatever
so
it suits you.
we're going to try to condense as much as we can into these 30 minutes. There's going to be a lot of information, although I trust that everyone here is not that's the brain power and intelligence is not the problem, to put it lightly. So we're going to do our best. I would urge people to, of course, ask questions and clarify anything, but just to keep in mind, we are trying to get a holistic picture with as much information as possible. So this first little discussion is going to be mostly philosophical, as we'll see, because in the most essential or perhaps even most important legal document on the laws of courts, it actually opens up with a very long historical and philosophical. And philosophical, rather, exegesis on Jewish court systems. And that is the work of the Tur, Yaakov ben Asher, the proto Shulchan Aruch on which Yosef Karo based his Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law. And as we'll see, this is actually this gives a very, very good segue into the more technical
And
and legal.
why does he do it? For historical purposes or just to establish why his court will be authentic?
So we're gonna so right. So this is what I wanted to touch on first of all. First of all, who is the Tor? Who is Yaakov the son of the Rosh? So many people first encounter the Tor in his commentary on the Chumash, right? The Tor, the Arba Turim, in the Chumash in the Mikros Gedolos. Sometimes it's printed in the more thin Chumashim as well. He has a very, very interesting story. And why does he have a very interesting story? It's mostly because of his father, who his father was. His father, the Rosh, Asher ben Yechiel. He's born in the Rhineland. In the mid 1200s, his teacher is Meir of Rottenburg, who is widely considered the last of the Tosafists. The Tosafists was a project that lasted three generations from the time of Rabbeinu Tam. We're talking like the grandchildren of Rashi. Three generations it took these massive, massive scholars that lived in France and in Eastern Germany to basically compare and contrast every single section of the Talmud that contradicted each other. This is a massive, massive project that literally took all the greatest minds of the generation and took them three generations to do it. And the product of that are all the texts of the Tosafos that we have today. There's no singular author, obviously. This is many, many different authors compiled. So as this project is coming to a close, or perhaps this is what caused the project to come to a close, there's tremendous, tremendous political instability going on in this part of Europe. Tremendous political instability. Right. The Maharam in Rottenburg, we just read on Tisha B'Av, we read the great lamentation that was composed by him in response to the burning of the Talmud. Sha'ali tisrof ba'esh, if I'm not mistaken, is the opening line. My beloved, the thing that I seek out has gone up in fire. This massive, massive burning of the Talmud in France, which was obviously government ordered. You can go to this place today. It's on the banks of the river of today. You can see where it was. They burned approximately 10,000 volumes of Talmud. It's incredible tragedy. It's not like today you can just go on safari and just see what the Talmud says, but
In
you
front of
don't
the church
have
they dirtied in
physical.
Notre Dame. The church got burned down not so long ago. So,
Oh wow, there you go. So what goes around comes around, I guess you could say.
yes.
So he watches this happen as a young man, Mayor of Rottenburg, and he sees the deterioration, the rapid deterioration of this going on as he becomes himself, as he steps into this leadership role. His teacher, incidentally, this is a bit of a tangent, but his teacher, Yechiel of Paris, who took part in the disputation when the church put the Talmud on trial, he actually took part in that. And by all accounts, the Jews did very well in this. They were basically up against, a panel of priests, asking questions on the Talmud left and right. It was basically two or three rabbis answering all these questions. They did very well, despite the fact they did very well. They still burned the Talmud. Not such a big surprise there. He leaves the country. He goes to Akko, along with hundreds of followers, opens up a yeshiva, which the Ramban will later on, when he comes to Israel, about 50 years later or so, he will. It's actually a little bit less than that. But when he comes to Israel, he will actually take over the yeshiva that Yechiel opens up in Akko. So anyway, Meir of Rottenburg stays on. He stays behind in France, or in Germany rather, and he becomes, basically the most important figure, most important figure in the Jewish world. He is imprisoned. Famously, the Maharam of Rottenburg is imprisoned.
By the way, I would say Ashkenazi world. I mean, there was another
Ashkenazi
world.
world.
Yeah.
Right. That's true. That's true. Yes. I should backtrack that a little bit. For sure, in that area of the world. Why is the Maharam of Rottenburg imprisoned? A lot of people are familiar with the story of Maharam of Rottenburg being imprisoned, and he dies in prison, and they were gonna redeem him, and then he gives a ruling on himself that he's not allowed to be redeemed. But why was he in prison to begin with?
I
He
think
was
he's
in prison to begin
ransomed, that
with.
he's arrested, but that they'd like to get ransom money, and they thought they'd get a lot of money out of him.
That's always an incentive, but the impetus for imprisoning this man is because he was trying to foment, and he successfully did foment, a mass aliyah movement from the Rhineland to leave and come to Israel, basically follow his teachers that had come years before. This was the reason. And back then, that was illegal. This was like a Soviet type situation during that era, where the church declared that all the Jews were basically the chattel of the treasury. So they weren't allowed to leave, and all their money belonged to the church. So if you tried to leave, it was like a capital offense. And not only did he leave, but he brought a bunch of people with him. So he's like, fomenting this rebellion almost. So you can
Wow.
understand, like, this story of like Jews
We
trying to
never heard
leave and
that.
like fighting the government, and they don't let them leave, and they don't let them come to Israel. This is not a new thing. This is not just like in Soviet times. They literally capture him for this reason.
Now, there were
His
300
teacher,
Toshes of France that pick up and go to Israel. That's, I guess, before him.
meant yes, correct. His teacher Yechiel, and also Rabbeinu Shimshon Mishanz, and a bunch of very other important figures had come earlier. That's true. They had come in that first wave that was immediately after the burning of the Talmud, where they're like,
Right.
guys, we can see the writing on the wall. It's time to get out of here. Meir of Rottenburg, their students, the next generation, he stayed behind to like run the show. But now he's like, there's no hope. We got to get out of here. And he's unsuccessful. He's unsuccessful. They catch him in Italy. They send note to him. He's like, if you don't come back, we're just going to kill everyone. So like he basically schleps back to France, and he's imprisoned. And his student, now we're getting back more to our, oh, excuse me, we're getting back more to our time over here. His student, Asher, actually successfully gets all the money together to redeem his teacher, even though it's an astronomical sum. It's like 20,000 marks, which is just, an incredible amount of money. He successfully gets this money together. Mayor of Rottenburg famously gives the ruling that it's forbidden to redeem him, and he languishes in prison, and he dies, I believe, 7 years later in prison. Now, shortly after Maharam dies, the political situation in France and Germany begins to deteriorate even more. The Holy Roman Empire, which was, basically the overarching political authority in that area, is becoming weakened, and the local dukes, the local, basically city-states, are gaining more independent power. And there's a lot of room for people who want to, cause mischief to start causing it if they want, because the central authorities are becoming weakened. This gives rise to a very, very horrible, horrible event, probably the most cataclysmic event, certainly in that period of Ashkenazi history, called the Rheinsfleisch pogrom. We don't know too much about this guy, Rheinsfleisch. We don't even know like what his name was from. Maybe it was like some type of pejorative name, because it means something like, destroyer of flesh or something like that. It's like a really harsh name. So this guy, what started off as basically an attempt to, kind of foment his own little niche of power in the area, basically in the Rhineland, the border area between France and Germany, ends up being this massive pogrom affecting some 120 Jewish communities are destroyed in this rampage of violence. Now, who are the people that are wiped out? It's not just like regular people. All of the students, the remaining students of Maharam of Rottenburg, again, the one who was imprisoned and languished in prison and then died like 3 years earlier, his disciples are killed. People that you've probably heard of, the Mordechai bin Hillel, who's his compendium of halachot are printed in the back of all the standard Gemaras. He's killed in this pogrom. He was only 40 years old, by the way, when he passed away. Already at the age of 40, he was considered, a master. He had accumulated, a huge, huge body of students. His colleague, who was also named Meir, incidentally, the Hagos Maimon. If anyone knows the standard editions of the Rambam, so there's the Hagos Maimon, which is the compendium of halachos from the Ashkenazi world that are relevant to whatever section of the Rambam that we're learning. So that Chacham was also killed in this pogrom. So it's just
First
this
of all, I can ask
horrible,
a question here.
frustrating.
It sounds like there's a lot of Chachamim, yet I've read from Rami Reiner, who's our neighbor in the Geffen, a professor of PhDs on Rabbeinu Tam, teaches at BGU, and I read all his papers that are in English. And it
So Rabbeinu
sounded
Tam is
like in
like
Rabbeinu
100
Tam's
years,
time,
over 100 years before this.
so at that time, very few Jews are doing mitzvahs the way we would imagine it, even tefillin. So this is in great contrast to all these chachamim. Like there's two, types of Jews there. There's like an elite group that's learned. I imagine they're keeping, Torah properly, and then the vast majority of others. I mean, do you know anything about that or?
I am familiar broadly with the point that you're making. I'm not sure how relevant it is to what we're talking about, but yes, for sure, there is a bigger gap. I heard in Merkaz HaRav, Rav Borstein, who heads Machon Pua, the Fertility and Halacha Institute, people are probably familiar with. He made a very poignant comment when Rav Eliyahu passed away. He said, "What defines the flow of the generations is that the gap between the leaders and the common people begins to shrink, and it's not just because it's also because the caliber of the leaders sometimes goes lower, but it's also because the le because." Like the level of the amcha goes up. Like people are more learned, people have more access to learning, and like the gap between the people at the top of the hierarchy and people at the bottom rung of the hierarchy is much smaller. So you can imagine someone like the person that we're talking about, Maram of Rottenberg, who was literally the Gadol Hador. Okay, he wrote the basis for our study of Talmud today. All of these works, all of these responsa, all of these commentaries, et cetera, which are the basis of Talmud study today. So someone like him, compared to the average French peasant who like knows basically nothing. Hold on just one second. Someone someone was coming back to fix the key. Sorry about that. Yeah, so for sure this is a relevant thing. But just to circle back to our current historical period that we're trying to talk about here. So after his master is imprisoned and dies in prison, and after all of his friends are killed in this massive pogrom, the Rosh, Asher ben Yechiel, he spends the next several years doing the best he can to try to help the communities of the Rhineland recuperate. He spends, I think, 3 years trying to do that. He's not particularly successful, and he hears that the government is already conspiring to arrest him, to do the same thing to him that they did to his master, Mayor of Rottenberg. So he's like, "There's no hope here. This is not going to go well for me." He schleps his whole family to Spain, which is extremely rare. It wasn't particularly common for this very prominent figure in Sarfat or Ashkenaz to go pick up and move to Spain. There was not a small amount of animosity between these two. I wouldn't say animosity, maybe that's too strong of a word, but there wasn't as much crossover back then as there was today, certainly not. And this is why the Rosh becomes a very, very important figure in the development of halacha, because he is very strongly a product of the Ashkenazi system. He's literally the prime disciple of the last of the Tosafists, but he's very much a product of that world. Yet he picks up and goes to Spain, and he spends the later years of his life. I actually don't know off the top of my head how long he spends in Spain, because he's already like an older man when he gets there. But he then becomes a very prominent figure in the whole Sfaradi, the whole Spanish tradition, which is why the Beit Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, he includes him in his main set, his main triad, so to speak, of rabbis in which he bases his psak on. So this is the Rush. The Rush becomes a very, very important figure. He becomes very famous as a judge, and not just famous in the Jewish world, but also famous in the non-Jewish world. And interestingly, in Tshuvas HaRash, I probably should have brought this up because it's just interesting to see. In Tshuvas HaRash, we have questions that were posed to him by non-Jews, and not just any non-Jew, but the Queen of Spain. The Queen of Spain comes and asks the Rosh a question. Just to give, just very, very quickly, just to give like a 10 second synopsis, just because it's an interesting situation. Basically, the court had deposited by a certain nobleman a tremendous amount of money for safekeeping. They said, we trust you. You need to hold on to this. We need to deposit it somewhere for a while. They determined when the person would return it. And then at the time came, there was just no response from this guy. He didn't deny it. He didn't say, yeah, I stole it. He just wasn't communicating. No response. And back then, it wasn't like you send a guy a WhatsApp message. Like you send a messenger that takes a week to get to the guy, comes back, no response. A week again, no response. Back and forth. It's like the conversation between, Bilam and the messengers of Moab, right? Like Bilam is sitting in like southern Turkey, and Moab is like southern Jordan. The whole conversation takes months, probably, that whole back and forth, right? So there's nothing going on. So they ask the Rush, what should we do? Should we relate to this guy as a criminal, or should we just relate to this guy as an annoying dude? So the Rush says, basically, long story short, he said the principle of umdana, the principle of circumstantial evidence, dictates in this case that you have to relate to him as a criminal. And he actually brings a proof from the famous case of Shlomo, where the two women come to him arguing over who's the mother of the baby. And he said, we see from here that you can rely on circumstantial evidence. He probably brought that example, to give the person context and a story that she was familiar with. Anyway, the Rosh becomes a very, very prominent figure, specifically in this area of adjudication, of civil law. Very, very, it becomes very, very central. And it's not just in a theoretical sense, but in a practical sense. He was a judge that had tremendous, tremendous experience. Who knows how many hundreds of cases came before him during his lifetime. So that's the Rush, and that's the whole like backdrop to how the Rush gets to that point in life. So his son, I mean, he has several sons, and all of them become very, very accomplished scholars, right? We have the responsa of Yehuda ben Arash, which you can still read today. But his most famous son was, for sure, by is not even a close second. His most famous son was his youngest son Yaakov, who's born in France, in Spain, if not mistaken. And he dedicates his life. His main work is to write these arbaturim, these four pillars, each pillar containing a section of Jewish law which is still applicable today. And he compiles it from all the previous sages that had came before him, and this becomes the basis for the text that will be written by Rav Yosef Karo some 250 years later, or 300 years later, known as the Shulchan Aruch. So this
Is
is
this
the
as
background.
opposed to the Rambam, who covers all area of halacha, and the
Correct.
Torah we see narrows it down? Why does that happen?
Right. So it could be that the purpose, I mean, it's not could be, it for sure is, that the goal of the Rambam and the goal of the Torah were very, very different. The goal of the Rambam was to be able to facilitate people growing in Torah study. Like this was, it had, I don't want to say academic because that makes it seem like, disembodied or ethereal, but it was certainly like he wanted people to be able to grow in Torah. Like he makes this clear in the introduction. I'm doing this because not everyone can go through the entire Talmud and all the rabbinic writings and come to like have any clarity. It's a very, very rare skill. So I want people to be able to have the entire Torah at their fingertips. If they want to know the Torah, they can know the Torah. They can know the entire thing. Just read this book, right? And do Chazara, and you can know the entire Torah. So it wasn't really his intention to have this as like a source of psak. Although he did, feel obviously that he was writing the correct conclusions from the Talmud, and this is used today, obviously, by scholars in giving rulings, but it wasn't his intention to give someone like, yeah, just read this book and you'll know exactly what it wasn't. It wasn't exactly like that. It wasn't like a halachic, handy halachic compendium. It was much more like read this and you'll know the whole Torah. And there are obviously philosophical sections also in the Rambam. It's not just legal. So he really wanted to condense the entire Torah into like an easily accessible book. That was the goal of the Rambam, whereas the goal of the Torah was much more practical, much, much more practical. And you see this, it's really the tradition of all the Ashkenazi scholars of that time where, whereas the Sfardim tended to produce the commentaries on the Gemara, right? The commentaries, like the commentary of the Rashba and the commentary of the Ritva, the commentary of the Ran, et cetera, where they're like helping you learn the Gemara, whereas the Ashkenazim tended to write compendiums, which were very halachically oriented. Like we mentioned the Mordechai before. The Mordechai is this massive compendium of rulings that have to do with the topic of the Gemara, but it's really geared more towards like, what do you do? Like what do you do in this situation? So like the approach was clearly different, and the goal was clearly different. So that gives us like the historical backdrop, which I think is just important to understand where he's coming from. So this is the tour. Now with all that introduction, so I'd like to go. I'm actually going to share the screen. I can share my screen.
And the tour is very readable. You could just read it.
As we'll see, this is the
But
opening section of the Torah in Choshen Mishpat.
mean, there's no art scroll on the tour.
Oh no. There's no art scroll in the Torah, but it is very, very accessible. So we'll just read a few sections over here because I think like it kind of gives some insight into like what's going on in his mind to the extent that we can know such a thing, and just to like get the flavor of this again before we in future discussions we'll get to the more technical halachic stuff, but this really gives a very strong philosophical basis for this.
And
So
like his father, was he also a judge?
who? Sorry.
Is the Torah, like his father, the Rosh, going to be part of a
I
Beit
don't
Din?
I don't believe I don't believe the tour was a practicing Dayan. Like I don't think that that's how he spent his time. So in that way he diverged from his father. I don't think he was like a full-time judge like the Rosh. So anyway, so the tour opens up. This is in section one of Hilchot Dayanim, the laws of judges. So he quotes the Mishnah in Avos. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Al shlosh dvarim ha'olam kayam, on three things the world stands, Al ha'din ve'al ha'emes ve'al ha'shalom, on proper judgment, on truth, and on peace. Uperish Rabbeinu Yonah, and he quotes Rabbeinu Yonah, the brother-in-law of the Ramban, who lived approximately a generation before the Torah, on his commentary to the Mishnah. Ein pirusha shebishvil shlosh dvarim elo nivra ha'olam. It's not the intention that this is the reason why God made the world. This is not saying, oh, the reason why God created the world is to have these three attributes. That's not what it's saying. Sherei betchilas haperek al shlosh dvarim ha'olam omeid, right? Which is an interesting topic in and of itself. There seems to be in the beginning of the first parak of Avos, and the very last Mishnah of Avos, which is this Mishnah, Yud Ches, there seems to be a contradiction because the first Mishnah says, on three things the world stands. And the last Mishnah says, on three things the world is sustained. And the three things that it lists are completely different things. So Rabbeinu Yonah is explaining, the first Mishnah is like a theological comment. This was the impetus for why God created the world. God created the world for, right? This was like the surge, so to speak, of divine will that created the world. The last Mishnah, the one that we're talking about now, is not talking about, it's not a theological statement per se. It's really observing the world and saying, these are the qualities that will make sure that the world does not descend into complete chaos. This is Kayam. This makes it sustainable on these three things, which is proper judgment, truth, and peace.
So you're talking about not the world, you mean civilization that they're living, the society,
Correct, correct.
not the world like in the days of Noah and a flood. I mean,
Well, I mean, I think that those things could be connected, but at the most simple level, that's correct. It's the former, meaning to make sure that society and civilization do not descend into chaos, these are the three principles that we need to uphold. So, skipping ahead a little bit, I'm going to highlight the sections
and
that we're
just
reading so we can follow along.
my simple understanding, the laws of seven laws of Noach are like they're out, because I thought that was the basis for the society, so to speak. If you don't have any of those, then you're in trouble.
So I think the question that you're asking now is the relationship between philosophical principles and the more specific compartmentalized laws. The seven Noahide laws are like specific laws, like do this, don't do that. They're very practical things. These three things are principles. Like how do you apply truth? How do you apply peace? It's very abstract. You have to apply it in a concrete way, and the concrete ways are, let's say, the seven Noahide laws. At the same time, however, a person needs to maintain the awareness that there's a philosophical backdrop over here, because if you follow the letter and lose the spirits, then that also is no good. At the same time, if you have a spirit, you have lofty ideas, but no way to apply it, that's also a problem. So combining those two together, combining the philosophical principles, which are these three things, along with whatever applicable laws there are, will give you the full picture. So anyway, I'm skipping ahead to section two over here. Again, just the highlighted section. I'll highlight it as I go along. So this is what it says in the Talmud of Masechet Shabbat. Kol hadan din emet la'amito. Any judge who judges a case truthfully to its full truth, which is an interesting expression in and of itself. It's like he becomes a partner in God in the creation of the world. That's what the Gemara says. So he's explaining this. He says, because God initiated creation in order so that the world can be sustained for the long term, obviously. And then he handed over those reins to human beings. So when the Gemara says that proper judgment makes the person a partner in with God, is because God created the world as such, right? The 6 days of creation, right? That period of initial creation where material reality as we know it came into being. So that was God's, his unilateral, let's say, input. And then we contribute to that by making sure that in the long term it will be stable, it will be kayam. The person who goes and cracks down on corruption and the acts of the wicked and makes sure that anything that has been stolen goes back to its proper owners, he sustains the entire world. Now he's going to go into something very interesting over here. He's going to go in and list over here how this theme of proper judgment, how it is introduced in the Torah when the very, very beginnings of the Jewish story, and how this theme actually is a through line throughout all of Jewish history. Now, it is a little bit lengthy. We're not going to go through every single milestone of this process that he lists, but it's very, very interesting how he points out that this is like the primary theme. The primary proper judgment is like the primary theme from Avraham Avinu all the way through the Mashiach. And I want to hone in on one particular example that he gives, in order that I think kind of underscores the idea very powerfully. But let's just read parts of the text that are relevant to us quickly. Va'Avram Avinu, right, our father Abraham, lo yodo Hashem v'karo avi, ela al asher halach b'derech hamishpat. Why did he call Abraham my beloved, and why did he draw Abraham close? Because he walked in the path of proper judgment. Where does it say that? Nichsiv, as it says in Bereishis, ki yedativ, I have known him. I have known him, meaning I drew Avraham close to me. Leman asher yitzaves banaves beiso acharav, in order so that he can command his household and his children after him. Lishmor derech Hashem, to guard the way of God. La'asot tzedakah u'mishpat, in order to do charity and judgment. Meaning, it's saying black and white, the reason I chose Avraham is because I was confident, I, God, was confident in him, that he would instruct his household in matters of proper judgment. That's why I chose him. He says it black and white. But Moshe Rabbeinu,
Even
although it
though
was no.
there's no Torah story to indicate that, there's Midrashim.
Yes, the subject of Avraham Avinu's background is a very, very big mystery. And it's interesting why the Torah intentionally leaves that out, even if we can kind of say, I mean, the Rambam famously has a whole section in his Introduction to the Laws of Idolatry, where he gives the backstory, like the origin story of Abraham, indicating that those stories are not just like midrashic metaphorical things, but actually meant to be understood as history. Like the Rambam says that this is meant to be understood as like the literal origin story of Abraham, which begs the question why the Torah intentionally left it out, which is an interesting question.
I
However,
would
the
say the
Torah
end of
is
Parshat Noach, they do show that he's willing to marry a woman who's sterile without a womb, his brother's
Exactly. Which is
daughter,
in contrast to what was going on in his generation, where people were
which shows that
concerned
he's a man
about.
of chesed.
Well, it shows also that he's not interested in making a name for himself. Meaning that whole generation, they were hyper focused on building the tower to make themselves a name. That was why they did it, right? V'naaseh lanu shem. We'll make a name for ourselves. And he's willing to marry this barren woman who, like, that's significantly lowering the chances that he's going to have a name, because a name and a legacy are through your children, through your progeny. But if you're taking on this barren woman, then those chances are significantly diminished. But it was more important for him to do, as you said, to take on this act of kindness, and you know, even though it was gonna hurt his name. So that's why that story is brought in the right. It like talks about the tower and then segues into Terach and Avram and that whole story, like to show you the contrast between those two things. Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Shalom, Moshe, our master, Rabban Shel Kol HaNaviim, he was the master of all the prophets. Lokach Atzas Yisro Be'inyan HaMishpat, meaning he was this incredibly wise person who was little, like the father of all the prophets, the master prophet who had this tremendous divine insight. He needed to take advice from his father-in-law Yisro about how to set up the court system in order to properly judge the people. And he gives more and more examples over here, and finally. The last example is of course the example that has yet to come to fruition. Vegam Melech Hamashiach, Sheigaleh B'mhirah B'yameinu, the one who will come, right? This figure that is described in the writings of the prophets, the one who will come to bring about, right, a full revelation, a full awareness of divine consciousness in the world. How is he meant to do this? Through Dvar Hamishpat, through proper judgment. Dichsev, how does he know that? Because it says explicitly in the verse in Yeshayahu and Perek Yud Aleph, "V'shofat betzedek dalim," that he will judge with righteousness the downtrodden, "V'ochiach b'mishur le'in ve'eretz," and he will give rebuke not in the sense of like finger wagging, but rebuke in the sense of like corrective judgment, "B'mishur le'aniyei eretz," and to straighten out the oppressed of the world. So the point, just to make this as explicit as possible, what the Torah is trying to highlight here is that this theme of proper judgment, of instituting proper civil law and dealing with these challenges in an organized and just way, is literally the through line that kicks off the Jewish project and is the culmination of the Jewish project. Starts from Avram Avinu and goes all the way to Melech HaMashiach. So this is like very, very essential. Now, I said I was going to highlight one of these examples over here just so we can, like, I think gives even more of an insight. If this wasn't powerful enough, it gives more of an insight into what the Torah is saying. What is the context of this verse that the Torah brings over here? He brings this proof text, which seems to be a very explicit proof that Avram was chosen because he would act out this thing of the tzedakah and mishpat. What is the context of that verse? Any Tanakh buckies over here want to take a shot?
What's the context of this verse? Said in English?
Ki yadativ, because I have known him, Avram, I, God, have known him, or I drew him close, in order so that he will command his children after him to walk the ways of God and to enact charity and judgment.
I think God's going to mention this, why he's going to reveal what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah.
There you go. That's the context. This is in Parshas Vayera when God says, "Listen, I'm going to destroy Sodom. I've decided that I'm going to destroy Sodom." As the verse says, they become so irredeemably horrible that there's no solution other than just to wipe them out completely, which is pretty bad. Like this is like, you know, a miniature flood story being relived, and it's pretty bad. So he says, "Of course, I have to tell Avraham about this." Why do I have to tell Avram? Because I drew him close in order so that he will command his children after him to guard my ways and act out proper judgment. Now, just to understand the basic meaning of it, like, what does one have to do with the other? Like, okay, you're going to destroy Sodom because you think that they're bad. Okay, so that's your business. Why do you need to tell Avram at all? And why is this the reason why you need to tell Avraham? The reason that you need to let Avraham in on the Sodom va'Amora thing is because he's the guy who's going to do proper judgment? Like, what is the connection between these two things? And we see that this very powerful conversation ensues between Avraham and God, where Avraham says, you know, listen, if there are a few righteous people, can't they redeem the whole city? Can't they make it worth it? And God says, okay, I'll save them if there's 50, if there's 40, right? He argues them down to 10. Great. But just the initial kickoff of this conversation, that God decides to tell Avraham about this because of this tzedakah u'mishpat thing. So what is the significance of that? So
I want to contrast Avraham with Noah, where when Avraham finds out, he argues on their behalf. He tries to do something. I mean, God could have sent him as a shaliach down there and do his best, like they would do today with Chabad. God chose not to do that. But Noach does absolutely nothing, apparently.
Noach just kind of listens to it, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. There's this little addendum in the Zohar Chadash, interestingly, where it talks about how basically Noach, drinks, like it's a commentary basically on the story that Noach drinks himself into a drunken stupor after the flood because of that guilt, because of the awareness that like he could have actually done something. Like instead, he just like listened to God's command. Okay, you want to destroy the world? I'll build this ark. I'll spend the next, 12 decades building this ark. If that's what you want me to do, I'm a loyal guy. I'm a righteous guy. I'll do it. But the recognition after the fact that he actually could have maybe stepped in and done something, it was that guilt that drove him into that whole incident afterwards, which is very interesting. Anyway,
Yeah, severe PTSD.
PTSD on steroids. Yeah, you can imagine. Like the world was literally destroyed because of me. Okay,
Right.
so just to try to finish this off, we're a little bit over time, but I want to just get this point across because I think it's actually quite insightful. This is the Mishnah in Avos. Okay, so just to recap on our question, what does the destruction of Sodom have to do with this tzedakah and mishpat thing? Like, what does that have to do with anything? Okay, so the Mishnah in Avos is a relatively famous Mishnah in Perek Hey of Avos. So it says Arba Minos Ba'adam, that there are four types of, let's say, four types of people, or four attributes that are expressed in people. Number one, Ha'omer Shali Shali V'Shelcha Shelcha, what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. Zu Mida Beinonis, this is the intermediary attribute. V'Yesh Omrim, however, there are those that say it's not the intermediary attribute, rather Zu Mida Sodom, this is the attribute of the Sodomites. Shali shali v'shelcha shali am ha'aretz. If someone says what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine, this is an am ha'aretz. This is just a fool, meaning he has no, like he's completely disoriented. He has no respect for the idea of property at all, not his own property and not anyone else's property. Shali shelcha v'shelcha shelcha chasid. Someone who respects someone else's property but is giving of his own property, that's a chasid. That's someone who is right. That's someone who's going above and beyond. He respects the other guy's money, but he's willing to give. That's ideal. And of course, the opposite extreme, Shali Shali V'Shelcha Shali, someone who only respects his own property but is willing to leverage someone else's stuff, that is a Rasha. Okay? Now, obviously, I want to focus on the first line of this Mishnah, which is very, very interesting. Okay? Shali Shali V'Shelcha Shelcha doesn't seem so bad, which is why Zumi Da Beinonis. Now, just to highlight on this, and when it says Mida Beinonis, right, describes these characters here in the rest of the Mishnah. It says this attribute is the attribute of the fool. This attribute is the attribute of the chassid, of the you know of the of the of the very righteous guy. And this is the attribute of the rasha, the completely wicked person. What would be the parallel term to describe the intermediary thing? Like, what would be the proper term to describe the intermediary? We use this all the time. It's a common term. The Beinoni.
You mean the
The
Benoni? The
Beinoni.
Benoni.
Yeah, the Beinoni. The Beinoni means like the intermediary person. But that's not what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says Zumida Beinonis. This attribute is the intermediary attribute. That's what it said. It doesn't say someone who has this, who lives by this principle, he's an intermediary guy. That's not what it says. It says this attribute is the intermediary attribute, and that's an important distinction, as we'll see in a moment. V'yesh omrim, however, in contrast, there are those that say, no, it's not the intermediary attribute, it's actually the attribute of the Sodomites. Now, just to understand what that means, this means that this attribute is the attribute of the people that were so bad, so horrible, so completely irredeemable that God had to wipe them out in this hailstorm of fire. Okay? That's like a big, that's not like two different, possible perspectives. That's like, one, two sides of the extreme. One, okay, it's like the average attribute. It's average. And the other opinion is like, no, this is like the worst of the worst. Why isn't this the Russia? Like, why isn't this the attribute of the wicked? It seems to be like very, very extreme.
And it's a little bit weird
What's
because
the
the world operates on that principle today.
Right. So you're just adding to the question. You're saying, like, how could it be so bad? How can this be the attribute of the Sodomites when this seems to be like the basis of how anything works? Like my stuff is mine, that's why it's called mine, and your stuff is yours because it's called yours. Okay, so to answer this question, I want to look at this verse in Yechezkel. The sin of Sodom, right, again, this city that God has decided to destroy, and says, I'm telling Abraham about this city because Because Avraham is the, he's the proper judgment guy. That's why I'm telling him about this. So people tend to think that the sin of Sodom had to do something with the incident that we hear about with Lot and the daughters and, this massive, mob of people that are going to essentially gang rape the Lot and his family. They believe it has something to do with that. And of course, the term sodomy, which has become a legal term, over the years, is influenced from that. That there's some type of sexual deviance that was at the root of what Sodom was doing. However, that is explicitly not the sin that Sodom was guilty of. Explicitly not. First of all, the Torah doesn't does in that story in Bereishis, it doesn't specify what the sin was. It just says Ra'im b'chata'im la'Hashem me'od, that they were very bad and sinful towards God. It doesn't say what they did wrong. You can assume, right? One could assume mistakenly that the sin had to do something with that whole story with Lot and his daughters. But that would be an error. And how do I know that that's an error? Because later on in Jewish history, we have a prophet that says it tells explicitly what the sin was. How do I know? From Yechezkel, Perek Tes Zayin. Hinei zeh haya avon Sodom achoseich. This was the city of Sodom. This was the sin of the city Sodom. This was the sin. Ready for the sin? Gaon sivas lechem, that they were very mighty and satiated with bread. Veshalva hashket, and they had complete tranquility and peace. Hayala to it and its subsidiaries. I mean, it wasn't just Sodom. It was like the whole environs. As we know, there were, five distinct cities that were wiped out in that incident. V'yad ani ve'evyon lo ichzika. However, despite the fact that they were very wealthy and that they had all this peace and tranquility, the hand of the downtrodden and the poor, they did not assist. Batigbehena, and they became haughty. V'ta'asena to'eva lefanai, and acted out abominations before me. Va'asiras hen, and therefore I removed them, ka'asher ra'isi, as I saw fit. Thus says God. So we see very explicitly that the sin of Sodom and Amorah was this problem. This problem of that it was an institutionalized practice that despite the fact that they were incredibly wealthy and incredibly successful, it says that Lot, right, when Lot and Avram have that split, and Lot decides to go down to the Jordan plain because he sees how wealthy they are. Like that's the reason why he goes. It says explicitly. I mean, just think about it. If Sodom was really like this lawless city where you had these mobs roaming the street, why would anyone want to move there? But it wasn't like that. It was actually a very successful, very peaceful place, and like that's why
It's
people want
like
to live
any
there.
other gated, it's like a gated community. If you
It's
can
like it's the
afford
ultimate gated community.
to buy in, you're great. It's great.
But the policy of this place was that we do not accept the freeloaders. We do not accept the freeloaders. And what is the right the end, right? It's not the excuse me, it's the second verse, right? But Tigbeena, and it became haughty and did abominations before me. Abominations in the Torah, this term toeva, abomination, can refer to one of two things in the Torah. What are the two things that it could refer to? It can refer to either idolatry or it can refer to sexual deviance, some type of sexual sin. We don't have any direct indication of any idolatry going on in Sodom, but we do have hints of some type of horrible sexual practices, namely this whole, this mob that's, that approaches the door
No, but why not
of
take the pshat that they have no sensitivity to those who need tzedakah? If you want to
That's
live there and
true.
you can afford it, fine. If not, you're out, which is
Okay.
most of the world is
So
like that.
this second clause, that because of their wealth, they became haughty before me, they became arrogant and did abominations before me. What does that mean? What does that mean? That because of their wealth and success, they became arrogant and began to commit abominations. What does that mean? So
Sounds
I
like
want to
America.
say what that means, and I think that this is just the pshat of the story, that what this means is that there was a policy in Sodom that we do not accept ani ve'evyon, we do not accept freeloaders here, and if you bring people into the city to freeload off of us, this is what we do to you, and that is the context of the mob that approaches the house of Lot. That's why they're coming, because they hear that he took in these people off the street. And they say, if right, the penalty for bringing people in here, and you see strategically why they're doing this. It's not like they kill the freeloaders; killing them won't do anything. If you do this to them, then they'll leave and spread the word that you don't come to Sodom to collect money. You don't try to get charity from Sodom, because if you do that, this is what will happen to you. This was the toeva, the abomination that they began to do because of the fact that they institutionally, right, philosophically, they had a philosophical stance that we do not assist the Yad Aniv Evyon, the hand of the downtrodden and the poor, and we enforce it with these horribly cruel tactics. That was the dynamic that led to Sodom's destruction. And we can see from here, this is exactly why God comes to Abraham and says, I need to tell you about this place, Sodom, because you're the person that can do tzedakah and mishpat. Why is that? Here, I'm gonna go back to the tour over here. When God comes to Avram and says, I know that you are the person that is able to enact proper judgment. But what's the way that he says it? It's not just mishpat. It's not just like giving the proper court case, but it's also tzedakah. Tzedakah u'mishpat. It's the inculcating, it's the integration, rather, of these two values of tzedakah and mishpat in terms of running a society. It's not this pure tyrannical, Ayn Rand version of, if you're poor, it's your fault and we're not helping you, that Sodom literally institutionalized in this horribly cruel way. But it's rather proper judgment nested within this bigger picture of tzedakah, nested within this bigger picture right, of kindness and charity. As we know, Avraham is very, very strongly associated with this attribute of kindness, right? Chesed la Avraham, as the prophet Micha says, right, that right, the attribute of chesed is onto Avraham. And this is why, because he was able to have this vision of a just society, meaning people, right, courts and judges and people that are executing the law properly, but embedded within this bigger structure of tzedakah. That's why God chose him. And if that's why God chose him, so of course he's going to tell him about this incident of this city that went wayward in this regard. Of course they had judges. Of course they had, a system. In fact, it's indicative from those psukim that Lot himself was this official, who Yoshev Bishar Sodom, that he's sitting in the gateway of Sodom. What does that mean, he's sitting in the gateway of Sodom? It means that he's the judge. The judges, they sit in the gateway, right? They sit in the gate of the city. And in fact, that's what the mob chastises him with when they come to his house to, to bring out the freeloaders. They say, "Me, who made you a judge over us? Why do you feel that you have the authority to be a judge over us?" They mock him. So they see that, right, there was a system of judgment and law and order in Sodom, but it was taken to such a horrible extreme that it ended up being not only corrupted, but just cruel beyond belief. And this is why Avraham is let in on the whole Sodom story, because of this reason. Avraham, I know that you can do this the right way. I know that you can actually execute this whole Mishpat project in the proper way.
But
And this
also,
is literally
Hashem
what he's
felt that these people were incorrigible and not educatable, and he chose instead to annihilate them, every man, woman, and child, with all their puppies.
You're familiar, Bruce, with the archaeological dig in Jordan, in Eastern Jordan,
Which one?
where they say influenced the Sodom story. The
No,
Smithsonian,
actually.
yeah, you should. This is worth looking up. I believe the archaeological dig is called Tell Al Haram. I could be missing that up.
I know
As
that
I'm talking,
Sodom
I'm
is
going to try
basically
to.
on the Jordanian side. They have a museum down there.
Exactly.
No,
Exactly.
that I'm familiar with
Yeah.
that.
So they
They
have
found graves of people. It's a huge cemetery of people there.
it's not a cemetery. It's a I'm gonna send the link to the chat so that people can see this, because it's actually quite remarkable. It's a dig in Jordan, right? Like not modern day Israel, but on like the Jordan side of the river. That the whole place was destroyed instantaneously in this cataclysmic like explosion of a meteorite. Now, as we know from watching Oppenheimer, the nuclear bomb doesn't like hit the ground and explode. It explodes like, many dozens of feet in the air. That way, the target can get the whole impact. So this was the same thing with this asteroid, apparently, that there was this huge asteroid that literally blew up because of the pressure contained within the rock and all the heat that it had accumulated from going through the atmosphere. It blew up over this area, over the Jordan Valley. Okay. And as they go on to explain, like Jericho, which was also in that area, was shielded essentially because of the mountains that surrounded it, so it didn't get destroyed. But this place, like whatever it was, like wherever this city was, Tel al-Hammam, excuse me, not Haram, Hammam, this place was destroyed in a fire, in a 3,000 degree fireball. They found in this site the element called trinitite, which is a unique element which doesn't appear naturally apparently, which you can only produce with intense heat. So in the Los Alamos test site, for example, when they first tested the nuclear bomb, so they found this element because like you need that level of heat in order to produce this element. So this is like this seems to be Sodom, guys. This seems to be like where it was. Like it says, God rained down fire and brimstone from heaven and just wiped it out in a fireball. Like this seems to be what it is. And yeah, like and you know, as horrible and incomprehensible as it is, what this story is giving over is that the second that tzedakah and mishpat become out of whack, the second that there becomes an imbalance in this, so something will destroy the civilization. Either it will be a direct act of God in the form of Sodom and Amorah, or it will be, you know, a less noticeable way, but it will, but it, but the conclusion will be the same. The conclusion of complete desolation, complete destruction will be the same.
This is
And
another
this is
point
what we're
completely,
left.
but the Rambam would like the fact that it was destroyed through a natural, not a supernatural event.
Well, you're right. I don't like that distinction because I don't think that there is like a categorical distinction necessarily. I think it's much more of a spectrum. But be that as it may, the point is God figured out how to handle it. He did it, you know, it's not like it's not like God is lacking options. Let's put it that way. So yeah, this I think is a very, very interesting historical and philosophical backdrop to the entire topic of Jewish courts. Please God, next time we get together, we will jump into the more practical side of things, which also has to do with much more general philosophical principles of how the courts function, but it will start becoming much more practical nonetless. So
That
yishar
was
koach, guys.
great.
I hope everyone enjoyed it,
Yeah, that
and
was terrific,
until next time.
Shammai. Thank you so much. That was great.
Sion b'mishpat Amen.
And I'll tell you for we'll
Oh,
discuss more next week.
in that spirit of what was just quoted, I didn't see who yelled that out that comment. Sion b'mishpat tipadeh, right? This idea that Yerushalayim is meant to be synonymous with judgment, right? Synonymous with proper judgment. That's not just like a nice poetic line of like, oh yeah, they're very just over here. That is supposed to be there, where people should look at, the Jewish people and say, yeah, these are like just moral people. But when it talks about Yerushalayim specifically being the city of judgment, that has a very practical intention. And that practical intention is that the Sanhedrin, right, the 70 most learned, capable scholars of the Jewish people that have the entire corpus of the Jewish tradition at their fingertips are sitting on the Temple Mount hearing cases from not just the Jews, but from all over the world. Why do you think they had to know? I'm sorry, I keep on knocking the computer over. Why do you think they had to know the 70 languages? Right? This whole thing that the Dayanim had to know the 70 languages. Why do they have to know so many languages? It's because the expectation is that when the whole world hears that there's this actual, like, real just court, that they don't play around. It's not like they draw out the cases for, 5 years like they do in secular courts, and it's a panel of judges of wise, learned, righteous people. That's where they're going to want to go to hear the cases. It's going to be the city of judgment. You're going to know, oh, Jerusalem, that's where the world court is. Right, exactly, Jerusalem. That's what it means, that Sion is going to be the city of judgment. It's going to be
Very
like the
interesting.
Sanhedrin in the center of the city where the whole world is going to come to hear
Also, you
judgment.
mentioned justice and morality. I'm not sure that the two are synonymous.
No, they're not at all. That's the important thing. That's why there's two distinct words for it. Mishpat is mishpat, and tzedakah is tzedakah, right? You can't
Right.
enforce tzedakah, which is a topic we're going to get to about enforcing tzedakah. Like, the rich landlord and the poor tenant, right? The classic scenario, right? You can't enforce these things. However,
I think the
we
final
are going to
Navi,
see. What, yeah.
when the final Navi says, "What does God want from you?" Tzedek and mishpat.
Yes, both of
Somehow,
them. He
both
needs
of them,
both.
but
Exactly.
they
Exactly.
sometimes
So mine is,
contradict.
well, they, well, they come in, well, let's say like this, they can come into conflict, meaning executing proper mishpat will be at the expense of a tzedakah outcome. But that doesn't mean that you can't have both of them coming out simultaneously. This Bezrat Hashem will be the topic of the next discussion. We're going to get into this people that struggled with this question, like people in Jewish history that struggled with this question of how to implement tzedakah and mishpat in a very practical sense and how to integrate them. So Bezrat Hashem. Okay, till next
Thank
time,
you.
guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you,
All right, go.
Shammai. Thank you. That was terrific. So, Arthur, what do I need to know about this?